The following interview was conducted for the Yachting Oral History Project of Mystic Seaport Museum Incorporated. The narrator is Mr. Colin E. Ratzy. The interviewer is Fred Calabretta. The interview took place at Mr. Ratzy's home in Boca Raton, Florida, on March 17, 1988.
Just so I have it, could we just start with your name?
My name is Colin E. Ratzy. I was born on April 17, 1926. At Neuchâtel Hospital, Neuchâtel, New York.
Okay. You had just mentioned Columbia and 1958, and that's something I did want to ask you about too.
Well, I was very fortunate in being crew on Columbia and working all summer long, which was a real education. And we were lucky enough to win the America's Cup to boot, so that was kind of exciting.
And you had quite a crew on that boat too.
I've got pictures in my den in there of, but we had Rod and Halsey and Toby Tobin, Fred Lawton, Jimmy Maslin. Our skipper was naturally Briggs, and incidentally, he's one of the finest gentlemen you'd ever want to race for or with. And it was very exciting and very wonderful. And Rod was, of course, also.
Did you feel like there was a lot more pressure in that situation than in something like the ocean racing or some of the other racing you had done? Was it a pressure?
There wasn't any in between. Either you were a hero or you were a bum. And, you know, it was one of those things because the syndicates had a lot of money involved. And they wanted to see the boats win. There's no question about it. And being connected with the sails and adjusting them and driving them back and forth to Newport was a pretty steady occurrence. But it was fun. A tremendous amount of fun. But it's 4.5 to 5 months of devoted work. And you live, eat, and sleep, and breathe it. And that's all you do.
It's pretty serious business.
Yes, it is.
So you would, when the sails needed adjustments or needed some work, you'd have to take them back to City Island?
And repair them or adjust them and bring them back again the next morning or something like that. Hmm. So I'd have a crew there waiting, you know, in the middle of the night, and they'd do it and go to sleep in the loft and then put them in the car and drive them up again the next morning. And 95 became a bit of a steady piece of road for me. But it was fun. It was very interesting.
And your uncle was on the British boat.
Yes, that year George Collin was on. He was co-helmsman on Scepter, and he made all the sails for Scepter, and we made all the sails for Columbia. And never at one time did we ever get together with the plans and what he did and what we did. Hmm. They were kept completely separate. Because that's how Ratzy was brought to this country. It was in the days of Mr. Vanderbilt and Mr. Morgan, when we were the only ones that had Egyptian cotton for the J-boats. And Mr. Morgan and Mr. Vanderbilt brought Ratzy to this country and set him up in City Island to make the sales for their boat. Huh. That's what started Ratzy in this country.
I brought my grandfather and my dad over.
And then, there were cases where probably sales were being made for more than one boat involved in cup trials or something like that. And how did you keep the, was there sort of a, what am I trying to say? You wouldn't let the people on one boat know what you were doing for somebody
In those days, they had maybe two or three different sailmakers doing it for, you very seldom had 100% exclusive. In other words, there was Kenny Watts, who did sails for Columbia. I think Hard had a few sails on Columbia. I don't know whether Homer had them or not. But there were two or three, but the main bulk of Columbia sails were ours. But they always experimented with other sailmakers. Like one would come out with a new shoot made by a Frenchman or something like that, and they'd try it. And when you have that much money involved in 58, which has seemed a lot today, it's absolutely out of sight. And that's why I think they're getting into the commercial aspect now, because there's no individual that can possibly afford to spend the kind of money they're spending today. And what they're going to make all these big sales out of today, I'll never know. I've been out of it too long now to speculate. Obviously, there's a material available somewhere that is going to do the job for them, but I wouldn't have a clue what it is.
What did Ratsey have any major competition in the say in the 30s or?
Oh, I think Ratsey always had competition. I think the biggest competition we had in the 30s was Press Wilson, maybe. There were a few others. That was really before my day. But yes, they obviously had competition.
And then, I guess more and more sailmakers started appearing on the scene after.
As soon as synthetics came out, then they started coming out of the woodwork. Because literally and honestly, it was a lot easier to make a sail out of synthetic than it was out of building something out of canvas and having the canvas work in. In other words, you get a sheet of metal and cut a sail shape out of a sheet of metal. It's a lot easier than designing a sleazy piece of fabric and having the thing go the way you want it to. It's a different, entirely different theory. Entirely different theory. In the old days, if a person didn't break in a mainsail by reaching and running with it before it was broken in, you could say to the customer that he ruined it. If he hadn't done it, went out in a gale. But with synthetics today, they can go out to 40 mile an hour breeze, and as long as the thing stays together, that's it. There's no breaking in period. That's so different. So different.
So if you did make a cotton sail for somebody and literally if they didn't break it in the right way,
it could be disastrous.
And it was their responsibility to they should yeah. know that's what it needed.
Well, they were told what to do, how to do it, everything else. I was always told, I don't know how true it is, that the tire industry is what set the trend for what synthetics that we used after the war, because they were the big users of the synthetic materials. Now, what truth that is, I don't know, but the tire industry uses millions and millions of yards of fabric versus the sailmakers. And if they come to fiber XYZ, it was thrown off on the sailmakers to try it. Now, I don't know how true that is, but I've had some pretty good people tell me that was pretty much it.
Ah, that's interesting. Was it easier to work with a major design firm, Rhodes or Sparkman Stevens, than it was for somebody who was building their own little boat and came to you and said, you know, we need sails? And
well, let's say this. There were more suggestions from our past experience given to this smaller architect what we would suggest that he does, whether he did it or not, by two different things. But the big design firms knew what they were doing. That's why they were where they were. But you'll find most of the young designers in those days used to work for the big ones. So they had a pretty good idea of what they were doing. I don't think so today, but in those days.
A lot of them started working
for
somebody like Rhodes or
Sparkman Stevens, and then went off on their own. And so do they do in the sailmaking. We used to, on a 4-year apprenticeship, I said to my dad one day, I said, you know, we're creating a monster for ourselves here. We're putting a chap through a 4-year course here, and the 5th year he sits so long, he goes and sets up on his own. That's what how Charlie Ulmer got started. Charlie Ulmer Sr. was George Ramsey's foreman. So then after about 48, 50, they didn't do the 4-year apprenticeship anymore. They'd either make a benchman out of you or a cutter or something else. But they wouldn't educate you all the way through.
It's interesting, but that was happening.
That was happening, sure. Because in the old days, you know, where they had apprenticeships in Europe, I remember Abbot King Erasmus and the big boat builders, they had 4-year apprenticeships for painters, carpenters, electricians, and they just kept the fellows on. But after the war, that didn't work. I don't know, the world changed. The world changed.
So when you, you did a regular formal 4-year apprenticeship?
Yeah, I punched the time clock, cleaned the men's room, the ladies' room out. I started right from the bottom. And I don't regret it one damn bit.
So you really, really got introduced to everything right from the beginning.
Yeah, that's the way my dad wanted it, and that's what happened.
Huh.
Yeah.
Was the during the summer or during periods, especially busy periods, how many hours a day or a week was work going on at the loft?
Oh, in the cup trials and things like that, there were hours, late hours. And in the real old days when they were making sales for the J boats and stuff like that, they'd work around the clock.
Yeah, right.
But in those days, my grandfather could open the door and whistle and have about 25 sailmakers up there that were good. And that didn't happen after the war. I mean, it was a totally different ballgame. But a J boat mainsail, I'll always remember, there was over a mile of canvas, 18 inches in width, if you laid it end on end, and weighed over 1 ton. And they gave us a 16-pound headboard, which you have up at Mystic, to hang it all on. And that took a little bit of engineering. And the head patches, for instance, were designed, and they were almost coffin shaped. And why this is, I'll never know. A coffin shaped patch will never come off. And they used them for the balloons in World War II over London. Because when aircraft would hit them, if they weren't coffin shaped patches, they'd come off. So that was one of the techniques of the sailmaker.
That's interesting. But you said that after the war, all these good sailmakers were no longer around or available to...
Some of the old timers, I'm talking about, the old craftsmen.
I see.
And in those days, too, they'd be just strictly benchmen. They couldn't do any cutting. They couldn't do anything else. And now the business is starting to get a little sophisticated with new techniques, synthetics, and whatever. And it was awfully hard to teach all these old guys the new tricks. And you had to be careful because they'd run you right in the ground. And we kept a lot of them as benchmen that you couldn't equal them. And some of the cutters that we had were fine cutters because they switched to the younger fellows. But, you know, it's like any other trade. I guess like a bricklayer or something like that. The bricklayers years ago are probably twice the guys that they are today. And most industries, I think, for this name. When it comes to a craft, workmanship, and people want to automate stuff today. And of course, it's better. Because if you had to make hand-made mainsail today for everybody, it would cost a bloody fortune. I mean, there's no way you could do it. Rod had a handmade mainsail made for Mustang, and I shouldn't have think you ought to ask him when he goes over these tapes and everything. Ask him what vintage that was. I think we made it for him right after the war, and I think it was 48, and I think he used that thing for over 10 years. I wouldn't, you know, I don't And Carlton Mitchell we made in the Caribbean also finished there. But it was a thing of beauty. And you'd never have to worry about a seam going. Except maybe the runners in a transatlantic race would chew up against it, but you had to watch that over the standing rigging. Because stuff does go in a transatlantic race where it normally doesn't go. But if you're alert and you keep things under control, you don't have control.
I wonder if they've, you know, there's sort of a...
The Brilliant that was up at Seaport belonged to Cunningham. She had the whole handmade stuff. I think she still has it. Is she still up there?
Yeah.
But if you go back in her sale log inventory, you'll go back and find some ratty sales that, my goodness gracious, they're 30 years old. Because Briggs had a lot of suits of sales for that boat.
And so the, as far as the handmade sales and the cotton sales, they just started.
Well, synthetic came into the picture.
After the war, so they started.
It didn't mildew, it didn't stretch, it didn't shrink, it didn't do this, it didn't do that. And the price was right. And it just took over, just like fiberglass in the hulls.
So like in the early 50s, you think?
Yeah, yeah. And it went from Orlon to nylon to nylon to Dacron, Dacron to fiber V, and then back to Dacron with the modifications 30. Of it. And then, like, of course, all the converters called it all different stuff. I mean, it was all basically the denier fabric of Dacron, I think you'll find. I could be wrong on that, but I'm sure.
How did the, you know, some of these old timers, some of the people that you were talking about, these craftsmen have been there for years. How did they feel when they started seeing this stuff come in?
Well, it was miserable stuff to work with. I mean, it'd take the hide right off your hands. I mean, that's why a ship like the Eagle or the square rig ships mostly had flax during the days, because when it got wet, when you get up in the yard on flax, you could handle it. Today they've got Dacron, but God only knows how they handle it. I mean, it's slick, slippery, it'll not last, though. You know, and it's just a whole different trend. It was definitely in the right direction. Because a good cotton mainsail, when you got through racing with it on a day race, you were supposed to take it home, put it over the clothesline, and wash it out, dry it thoroughly, and that was a pain in the neck. And with the Dacron, they said it didn't mildew, but it used to. It didn't mildew and hurt the denier, so to speak. It would mildew in the coating, so it wouldn't really weaken the yarn, not like in cotton. And you could get it out of most Dacron, but the only thing to take mildew out of cotton was a knife.
Once it was in, it was in. So a lot of people, well, there seems to be a lot more interest lately in wooden boats, and some people are getting more interested in restoring boats, or building wooden boats. And I wonder if you think that there'll ever be a little more, that sort of interest will come back, and people will realize they're going to all this trouble building a traditional type boat that they ought to get some cotton sales for it.
Well, Brett, down here in Florida, where I've only lived for 5 years, having a wooden boat down here is driving me crazy, because the sun will just eat it up. There's no question about it. Now, if you're retired and you have nothing to do but go down and varnish, paint your little wooden boat, that's fine. But you've got to thoroughly understand that the maintenance of the thing is going to be tremendous. So very few people, you know, are going the wood route. Maybe somebody that's traditional that loves wood and wants to do it. But my goodness, gollywog, my Nevin's 40 was all wood. And I mean, she was varnished topsides, and you couldn't have a boat like that down here. There's no way you could.
That's what I asked.
No. I mean, today varnishing that boat, I said I don't think it would have cost. I mean, it cost enough from the days that I had it. But to keep that boat down here, you have to varnish it, varnish it, varnish it, and varnish it. And it just wouldn't be practical. So that's why the fiberglass is what it is today. They can get a steam hose and clean it a lot.
20.
And people don't spend the money on boats like they do up north down here, from what I've been able to see.
I mean, they'll take them home in their backyard and scrape them down
and do a big thing on them. Whereas very seldom you see that up north. They might do it in some shipyards, but very few. But they do it. They tow boats down here a lot. They tow them for miles. So sailing down here too is, Long Island Sound is the greatest piece of water in the world. And you never realize it when you're up there. Because you can go 100 miles or you can go any portion of that and be in moderately protected water. Down here, where can you go? Either go over the Keys or down to the Keys, or you go over to Nashville or Freeport or up the coast or down the coast. That's all you can do. And having a sailboat down here is, it would not be my preference choice. I think it's fun to go out with other people and tear up their equipment, but not my own.
When you were growing up, I know the business was on City Island, but did you live on City Island?
No, I never did. My dad did.
Oh.
My dad and his dad. I was born in Urshell, lived in Pelham Manor for years, moved from Pelham Manor to Larchmont, went to in the Navy in Larchmont, came back and dad had moved to Rye, and then lived in Rye for over 30 years. And then we moved up to Fairfield, Connecticut. And then Fairfield down here.
22.
I guess there was, in the 30s and later, awful lot of activity, yachting and sailing activity on City Island.
Well, City Island was the hub. I mean, when the Rostrums and the Rosenfels and everybody lived there, I mean, it was the yachting center of the Eastern Seaboard. And they had the famous shipyards, Nevins and Minifers were going strong, and Kretzers. And it was a yacht haven. Yeah. It was a yacht haven. You talk about a hub of a wheel, and it was only about 45 minutes from New York City. And then after the war, they built all these big skyscrapers down in Co-op City and everything, and that kind of did a number on City Island. And then I haven't been up there now for 10 years, and I hope it's still going strong. Because it is a wonderful place. Everybody knows everybody else.
23.
And, I still have some sailmakers that are retired or live up there still.
Is that right?
Yeah. I get Christmas cards from them. I call them occasionally.
Are there any real old timers up there?
Yeah. In their 70s. Of course, that used to seem old as hell to me. Now it's getting to be, you know, average. Yeah, it really is.
23.
But I loved every minute when I was connected in the industry, and I just thank my dear life that I was fortunate enough to be able to do it.
End of original recording.